Our second case this morning is United States against Nieto. Counsel for the defense.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Major Brian Jackson, and I represent the appellant in this case. It is well established that the military judge and a court-martial is much more than a mere referee. As this court noted last year in United States versus Walford, the military judge has an obligation, an affirmative duty, to ensure that the appellant receives a fair trial. Consequently, if it is true, as this court has previously noted many times in the past, that the voir dire process is critical to the fairness of a court-martial, then it necessarily follows that the military judge has an affirmative duty to exercise, rather than advocate, his broad discretionary power to restrict the voir dire examination to that which is proper and pertinent for the testing of the capability and capacity of potential court-martial members. The appellant submits that the military judge in this case failed to meet that affirmative duty.
With respect to which members did he fail to meet that duty?
Essentially, at first, all of them, sir, we contend that the group voir dire questions were improper, specifically the one that required the groups as a whole to weigh and compare how they would weigh the military character evidence against the government's evidence of the collection of the opponent's urine. When the trial counsel asked in front of the group...
You have two groups of questions, so that's the group question, and then your specific chain of custody question?
Yes, sir.
And to whom were those directed?
Those were directed to each individual member. During the group voir dire, the trial counsel asked a generic question. Who here believes that violations or deviations in the collection process invalidate your analysis? And everybody answered in the affirmative. Based on that question, the trial counsel individually explored that area to the point where he got into the specific and material facts of the case and essentially, tried his case during voir dire.
Did he get into those facts of the case?
Excuse me, sir?
Who did he do that with?
He did that with all of them.
With you doing it, though, and not me, the government's argument that ultimately there was no prejudice, even if you're correct.
Yes, sir. There was prejudice indeed.
That's a surprise, no.
for several reasons. To top off, the first, Corporal Lopez. Corporal Lopez was challenged by the defense counsel. But you'll see in the joint appendix.
Did the defense counsel say that I would have challenged somebody else if I didn't have to use it on this version?
Exactly, sir. You'll see at page 71 of the joint appendix, Corporal Lopez says, yes, minor deviations in the vote in the collection process might affect my opinion and the reliability of this test. But then, because of the military judge's abuse of the discretion that he had, the trial counsel was allowed to actually go through and spend almost a page talking to Corporal Lopez about the government's evidence, and at the end, Corporal Lopez was convinced that the trial counsel's case was straight, that the accused was guilty, and the defense counsel had no possible ability to actually convince him during his case in chief. Consequently, because of that line of inquiry, the defense counsel was forced to use his peremptory challenge to challenge Corporal Lopez because he was improperly prejudiced during that voir dire process. In addition, Chief Warrant Officer Clark, he was talked into a position favorable to the government. Chief Warrant Officer Clark maintained he still remained on that panel because
was he challenged by the defense?
He was not, sir. He was not challenged for cause. Chief Warrant Officer Marker was challenged for cause previously, and that might be the reason why the defense counsel didn't. The government initially challenged Chief Warrant Officer Marker for cause because the trial counsel could not talk Chief Warrant Officer Marker into convicting the appellant prior to the trial. Chief Warrant Officer Marker said, I need to look at the entire case. I might be inclined to say, yes, this isn't reliable based on what you tell me.
The challenge wanted Marker, didn't they? They objected to the government's challenge.
Yes, sir.
So now you're here saying, having objected to the government's challenge, the military judge nonetheless erred by not granting it.
No, sir, that is not the appellant's position whatsoever. When the defense counsel got a chance to actually speak to Chief Warrant Officer Marker, he was able to bring out that Chief Warrant Officer Marker would be able to withhold his judgment as to the guilt or innocence of the appellant until the end of the trial, that he would be able to look at the entire process and then make his decision based on the entire evidence. Based on that rehabilitation, the military judge denied the government's challenge as to Chief Warrant Officer Marker. That is why he was able to sit on the panel.
Different state courts apply different theories or tests regarding proper or improper questioning during voir dire. What tests would you hope or recommend that this court apply, if any?
Yes, sir. That's the
here I'm particularly looking at comparison, for example, in the Texas case of Stand Effort, there's an effort to actually come up with a actual test, a TikTok, as opposed to you know it when you see it, which is how generally the courts have approached this. Are you recommending a particular map for us, or are you just asking us to find it where we see it?
I'm not recommending a particular stringent test. I believe Texas, Colorado, Florida comes close. Those states come close to putting out stringent guidelines for the trial judges to follow. What we do suggest is that this court put out guidance for the trial judges to, in fact, exercise their broad discretion in regulating this process. And that guidance should involve caution against allowing either counsel to discuss with the potential members the material facts and pieces of the evidence, selected pieces of the evidence during voir dire. It's our position that when the military judge, in fact, allows either counsel to get into the material facts, to get into particular pieces of evidence, then you necessarily get away from the pursuit of bias and prejudice, and you get into the area of allowing the trial counsel to discover how each member will find or deliberate in the case. And that's in fact what happened in appellant's case.
Okay, you've got Lopez is gone.
Yes, sir.
Marker is gone. And your Marker was peremptorily challenged by the government.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. Okay, Lopez is gone, Marker is gone, and the judge has cautioned the members that you decide this case only on the evidence.
Yes, sir.
Now, where's the prejudice?
The prejudice is that that caution that came from the judge came at the conclusion of the trial. When the members sat, during that voir dire process, they were potential members. They're sitting, they were in a vacuum, they knew nothing about the case. What the military judge allowed to the appellant's prejudice, what the military judge allowed the trial counsel to precondition those members, of particular, we're talking about Chief Warrant Officer Clark, because he maintained on the panel.
But the defense didn't challenge him.
No, sir. No, sir. He did not challenge him for cause.
But nonetheless, having not challenged him, the defense is prejudiced by his presence.
Yes, sir, he was. It is our position that this preconditioning, poisoned the deliberation process because Chief Warrant Officer Marker, when he went into that deliberation room, he had already committed to
Clark.
I'm sorry, Clark. He already committed to finding on the government side.
We should not presume that he followed the judge's instructions.
We should not presume that, sir.
Because that's not the rule in the military law?
It is in fact the rule in the military law. But we're talking about human experience, and we're talking about the ability for a member to actually hear a trial counsel discuss the material facts during voir dire without presentation of any evidence whatsoever.
Well, counsel, does your test work for both sides, or is it just for government counsel?
It works for both sides, sir.
So you don't want, for example, defense counsel to be able to ask questions of potential members as to whether or not they were going to believe the testimony of law enforcement people over other people when there, in fact, are going to be law enforcement people testifying, or to probe their views with respect to eyewitness testimony and whether it's infallible when there's going to be eyewitness testimony, because I would assume that you wouldn't want that to be the rule.
When would you not? And in fact,
How is that different than what happened here?
When a counsel, either counsel, uses hypothetical scenarios that include material facts to test whether or not a potential member can follow the law, for example, or can follow the judge's instructions, that type of question would be appropriate. And I believe the scenarios you gave, I think, would either involve a question of whether or not that member could follow the law or could follow a judicial instruction.
No, it was whether or not they would believe the testimony of someone in law enforcement over other people and their views on the infallibility of eyewitness testimony.
I believe
are not tied to any instructions. Their personal opinion on those two pieces of information when that information, in fact, was going to be presented at that trial.
Yes, ma'am. I believe in every trial, such as the one you described, a military judge would be required to give instructions to relay just that the members cannot, you know, weigh one person's credibility over the other simply because of their title. And that question is seeking that type of prejudice. That question is seeking to determine whether that potential member can follow the military judge's later instructions. It actually speaks to whether or not that particular member is prejudiced against or for one side or the other.
Well, you started giving a response to me that seemed to imply that if the military judge had instructed earlier, he would have immunized these guys, but when he instructed when he did, he didn't.
Yes, sir.
Now, well, is that your argument?
That is our argument. What we contend is that the military judge should have stopped that voir dire right at that moment and sua sponte provided an instruction as to, you know,
sua sponte provided the instruction that he did provide later.
That he did provide later, but, yes, sir. In fact, but because he didn't, he allowed those members to actually commit, in this particular instance, the one member to commit to the government side, and by the time...
Which member? Clark?
Yes, sir. And by the time the appellant had a chance to present his case in chief, he had no chance whatsoever with that member. I see my time is up.
You have an opportunity on rebuttal.
Thank you, sir.
Counsel for the government.
May it please the court, my name is Lieutenant Justin Dunlap, and I, along with Colonel Louis Puglio, represent the government. During voir dire, the trial counsel used hypotheticals which were patterned after the facts present in the appellant's case. The question before this court is whether trial counsel's questions during voir dire were proper. The government's position is that trial counsel's questions during voir dire were for a proper purpose and did not commit the members to a verdict in the case or commit the members to facts that were tantamount to a commitment to a verdict on the case, in the case.
What test should we be applying to determine whether questions are proper or not?
Well, first of all, Your Honor, in this case, the test that should be applied is plain error. The accused in this case never objected to any of the questions asked during voir dire, so the standard review should be plain error.
If I could interject there, and it's Judge Baker's question, but you started out by asserting there was no error in this case. So from the perspective of whether there was error as opposed to plain error, what's the standard that we apply?
Although this court has never addressed specifically the issue of whether hypotheticals on voir dire may be asked, the standard that the government would advocate would be that the court set out a rule where questions that would commit the members to a verdict in the case or the facts that are tantamount to a verdict on the case may not be asked during voir dire. However, if the purpose of the voir dire question is only to expose the members' bias or to explain the law to the members, that is an appropriate purpose for a voir dire question. And in fact, that's what happened.
Are you pulling that out of the Stand Up for case, or where are you getting your commitment questions concept from?
Both state and federal law seem to stand for the general proposition that a counsel on either side may not ask commitment to the verdict questions, but they may ask questions that expose bias or explain a law. And certainly the Texas Court of Appeals case that Your Honor just mentioned stands for that proposition as well.
Well, Counsel, if it is improper for the government to ask for a commitment on an issue that's going to be litigated at trial, why isn't that the case then when the trial counsel asked Clark about the initialing of the bottle, which was an issue in this case, and he asked whether or not on pages 51 and 52 of the joint appendix that if the coordinator had failed to initial it, would that make a difference? And Clark said, no, that wouldn't make a difference. That was an issue that was going to be litigated, and here the government got him to give him an answer before any of the evidence was ever introduced. Why isn't that a problem?
Your Honor, the purpose of the trial counsel's question was not to get a commitment from Member Clark to the fact that he would find your analysis in this case valid.
Well, wait a minute. I'm not sure whether we know what the purpose is, but we know what was asked and we know what was answered. And what was asked was, would you have a problem if the coordinator didn't initial it? And he said, I wouldn't have a problem, and that was an issue. Now, I'm not sure whether the purpose behind the question is important at this point.
If Your Honor would direct counsel to the particular page.
It's pages 51, it's 51 and 52 of the joint exhibit. I'm not exactly sure which page it's on. Where trial counsel asks, it wouldn't necessarily be per se invalid if the coordinator didn't put his initials on the bottom, on the bottle, let's say.
Your Honor, the government would draw a very important distinction between asking the member whether or not they would per se invalidate the urinalysis, which would seem to hold the government to a higher standard than proof beyond a reasonable doubt, and asking the member whether they would consider the urinalysis valid. There's a clear distinction there. The question that was asked by trial counsel in this case was going after whether or not the member would hold the government to a proof of standard, a stricter standard than proof beyond reasonable doubt. That would be asking about this per se exclusion rule. The government would grant that had the member been asked, you know, would you consider this to be a valid urinalysis? That would be an improper question, but that's not what was asked here.
Okay. Let me go to one of the general questions. I guess it was number three. Does any member believe that the evidence of the accused's military character by itself is sufficient to outweigh other evidence of the accused's guilt? And that seems to me to be asking whether or not they believe that evidence of good military character, no matter how strong, would be insufficient to outweigh other evidence of the accused's guilt. And later in the trial, the military judge gave an instruction that said evidence of good military character may be sufficient to cause a reasonable doubt as to his guilt. Now that seems to be in conflict with the third general question that was asked, and that doesn't seem to be committing them to something. It seems to be an erroneous or a misstatement of the law, and is that something that we should ignore?
Your Honor, the government would certainly grant that question was inartfully asked by the trial counsel in the case. But the purpose of the question does not seem to be, as you say, to commit any member to a verdict in the case. Simply, the counsel seems to have misstated the law somewhat in that particular question. But if the court would look to the counsel's next question, the trial counsel seems to right the ship when he properly advises the members that do the members understand that you determine how much weight, if any at all, to give evidence of good military character in determining the accused guilt or innocence. So while the first question the government would grant was somewhat of a misstatement of the law, the government properly instructed or explained the law to the members with the follow-up question. And to the extent that this court would find any error in that question, it was certainly cured with the military judge's instructions at the conclusion of the trial, both that on page 305 of the record, he said to the extent what counsel explains with regard to the law, if at any point it conflicts with the instructions I give you, members, you're required to follow my instructions, not what the trial counsel said. And also, as Your Honor alluded to on page 308 of the record, the judge instructed that evidence of good military character may be sufficient on its own to cause reasonable doubt. So to the extent there was error, it was certainly cured by the military judge's instructions.
What do you say to the defense contention that he instructed at the wrong time, that he instructed too late and it was too late to immunize the members?
The point the government would make with that, Your Honor, that's why it's so incumbent upon the appellant, if they think an improper question is being asked, to object. And that simply didn't happen here. And the issue was waived.
Well, the appellant would say, I objected on Lopez, and then I lost my challenge because of that.
Well, Your Honor,
I'm switching gears on you, I suppose, but what's your response to the appellant's argument that on prejudice, that he had to use his peremptory challenge on someone who otherwise should have been removed for cause?
Had the defense thought that inappropriate questions were asked of Corporal Lopez, the appropriate thing for the defense to have done would have been to challenge for cause Corporal Lopez. They never did that. They simply peremptory struck him. So if they thought he was somehow tainted or he had been asked inappropriate questions during the individual voir dire, they should have objected to the questions, or they should have challenged him for cause. The appellant in this case did neither. Turning to the question of whether trial counsel's hypotheticals during voir dire were error, this court has, as I say, never set out a standard exactly on what hypotheticals, to the extent to which hypotheticals may be used on voir dire. However, the general rule seems to be that hypotheticals may be used to expose bias or to explain the law to members, but it may not be used to commit the members to a verdict in the case. Again, at no point did the trial counsel in this case set out to commit the members to a verdict in the case. The purpose of trial counsel's
Is that an objective or subjective test, going back to the questions that were asked earlier? Does it matter what the internal purpose of the trial counsel was, or do we just look at the questions themselves and determine what their impact was?
The standard this court should set out would be that if a defense counsel thinks a question is being asked for an inappropriate purpose, that is to commit the members to a verdict in the case, the defense must object. At that point, the trial counsel is forced to articulate on the record what the purpose of their question is.
So your position is that the military judge has no responsibilities whatsoever, even if the question on its face is a clear commitment question?
No, Your Honor, the government would not agree with that. There are going to be certain questions that on their face are clearly committing the members to a verdict in the case.
Well, I was just looking at your prior response in which you said it was up to the defense counsel to make the objection.
In normal circumstances, it will be. However, there are certainly going to be some questions that are so beyond the line in that they commit the members to a verdict that it is the sua sponte duty.
Is that really the limit, commit to verdict? So it doesn't, you can get them to commit to how they'll view certain evidence as long as they don't commit to a verdict?
If the hypothetical is tantamount to having them commit to the verdict, that would also be precluded.
Give an example.
So you can piecemeal it and just get them to commit to how they'll interpret all your evidence.
No, Your Honor.
Each individual piece is not tantamount to a verdict.
If the trial counsel's attempting to ask a series of hypotheticals, which in the end will ultimately commit the members to a verdict in the case, that would clearly be precluded. Now, much of this, Your Honor,
do individual questions that commit him to treat individual pieces of evidence, are they improper?
If it's asking for a factual determination by the member on whether or not they're going to consider a piece of evidence a certain way, that would seem to be inappropriate. However, this whole inquiry is it's key that the accused at trial objects so that the accused, the trial counsel, and the military judge can parse out what exactly is being asked and why. That didn't occur here.
Well, wouldn't we just use the normal test, which is that, you know, if the test is going to be that they can't get a commitment to a verdict or something that's tantamount to a commitment to a verdict, that the defense needs to object, but when we review it on appeal, we're going to use plain error, which is even if the defendant didn't object, if it was clearly and obviously such a question, that we will nonetheless say that it was error.
Certainly, Your Honor. If
the military judge didn't jump in and do what he should do.
Certainly, Your Honor. And there will be cases out there, using the facts of this case, suppose the trial counsel had gotten up and said, if the evidence shows in a hypothetical case that the government followed all proper procedures for the collection of the urine, but that the urinalysis coordinator didn't initial the bottle, is there anyone who would not convict the accused under those facts? That is plainly an inappropriate question. And even if the defense counsel, under that hypothetical, did not object, it would be the duty of the military judge at that point to say that's an inappropriate question, but it's committing the members to a verdict. That's not the facts in this case. At no point did the trial counsel in this case attempt to commit the members to a verdict in the case. What he was doing was seeing if the members would hold the government to a proof of, or to a stricter standard than proof beyond a reasonable doubt. This is certainly a question that was more in that gray area, which is why it's so incumbent upon the defense counsel to object if they think the question's improper. Here, the defense counsel did not do that. Now, the appellant's heavy reliance on the Texas Court of Appeals holding in Atkins v. State is misplaced. First, in Atkins, the appellant objected to the government's hypothetical during voir dire. Second, unlike the appellant's case, in Atkins, it was clear that the objective of the trial counsel was to commit the members to a verdict in the case. There, the trial counsel asked, if the government shows you that the accused was arrested in the possession of a crack cocaine pipe with a residual amount of cocaine inside, is there anyone who could not convict? Unlike Atkins, in this case, the trial counsel's purpose was not to commit the members to a verdict in the case, but rather to see if the members would hold the government to a stricter standard than proof beyond a reasonable doubt. And it's important that the court look back to trial counsel's question during general voir dire, where he asked, does any member believe that any technical error in the collection process, no matter how small, means that your analysis is per se invalid? All members replied that they would apply such a per se rule. That's on page 23 of the record. So during individual voir dire, when the trial counsel was asking these hypotheticals, his purpose was to see if all of the members were going to apply such an inflexible standard in viewing the government's evidence so that any deviation, no matter how small, would automatically invalidate the error analysis. That is clearly a standard that is stricter than reasonable doubt, and it was one that was appropriate for the trial counsel to examine the members on.
Voir dire has been going on for a while in the military system. Why do you think there's so few cases, if any, on this particular issue?
In the military context, Your Honor, or in state and federal law?
No, military context.
The government's not sure why this particular issue hasn't been spoken on, and frankly, this government counsel doesn't know how often tri-counsel are asking these hypotheticals, but under the facts of this case, it certainly seems appropriate, and I'm not sure I can answer that question.
No,
do you think
it be speculation in any event, but I was
yes,
interested
sir.
In what you
yes,
would
sir.
Say.
Do you agree with appellant's counsel that whatever the test would be, it would be equally applicable to the government counsel and defense counsel at trial?
Your Honor, I see that my time has expired.
Please take your time to answer the question.
Thank you, Your Honor. Yes, ma'am. This is certainly a test that needs to apply both to the government and towards defense at trial.
If you'd like to briefly conclude, you may do so.
Yes, Your Honor. In conclusion, there was no error in the appellant's case because trial counsel's voir dire was for the appropriate purpose of testing the members for bias and not to commit the members to a verdict or to facts tantamount to a verdict in the case. And even if this court finds the trial counsel's question was error, the appellant has waived the issue and cannot demonstrate plain error. If there are no other questions, the government asks this court affirm the findings and sentence of the court below.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Does the defense have rebuttal?
To follow up on the judge's question as to why there are so few cases in this regard, the appellant does have an opinion. Our opinion is that it's because most military judges exercise that broad discretion. Most military judges cut off trial counsel when they attempt to try their cases during voir dire, as this trial counsel clearly did. We have to look, when we look at this case, you know, the question was asked whether or not the voir dire questions were tantamount to a commitment. Of course it was. We have to look at this case in the context of what it was. It was a contested voir analysis case, a case where there were no witnesses, no confessions, no admissions. We had on one side the government's voir analysis test, on the other side the appellant's good name and good reputation. That trial counsel, when he walked up to that podium during voir dire, he knew that. And he knew that he had to do something to discredit that military character, all the while bolstering his botched urinalysis test. So that's what he set out to do. First during voir dire by saying, and it was on purpose, he was saying in voir dire, but can you or will you weigh military character by itself, can military character outweigh our evidence? He did this on purpose. We know this because that was a question that was in his written questions proposed to the judge. It's in the record. He wrote it out explicitly like that. So he knew, and on purpose he did that for a reason, and that is to cut off any military character consideration by the panel.
So was this a written question that was presented to defense counsel ahead of time for the
yes,
review?
Sir. I mean, yes, ma'am, it was.
Well, if good military character was so critical in this case, as presumably it was, why didn't the defense counsel object?
I cannot tell you why the counsel objected.
Why
did not fail to object, but I can tell you.
Well, why didn't the defense counsel seek to strike all of the members on the basis that they had been irrevocably tainted?
Ma'am, after this court's decision in this case, I'm sure all defense counsel will do that. But we know that there was a military judge in that particular, in that courtroom, and he knew that this was prejudicial. And he should have exercised his discretion in a way that prevented that. There's no excuse for him not doing this. Additionally, the loss of the peremptory challenge. The Supreme Court has mentioned that the peremptory challenge is one of the most important of the rights secured by the accused. Denial or impairment of that right is reversible error without a showing of prejudice. This clearly happened after the trial counsel improperly used voir dire to his advantage.
That's with respect to Lopez?
With respect to Lopez.
Yeah, the government took issue with your assertion that the appellant lost the challenge. Government said you didn't preserve it.
Yes, sir. That's another issue where the defense counsel should have actually challenged for cause. We can only speculate as to why he didn't, and that is because Lopez fell in the same category that Marker did. The one that was denied that the government attempted to challenge. That was, yes, Chief Warrant Officer Marker, in that he did commit to one side or the other, in this case the government side, but then he was also said he would have both himself. In conclusion, the appellant submits that these types of questions should be forbidden by this court. This court will respectfully request that this court send the military judges guidance as to how they should deal with trial counsel using material facts in this case and selected pieces of evidence in the case to commit members to one side or the other. When this is allowed, when the military judge abuses his discretion to allow this, the only thing we have is panels that favor one side or the other. The only thing we have is unfair use of the voir dire process. In this particular instance, that unfair use of the voir dire process operated to the appellant's prejudice, and this court, respectfully submit, should reverse the lower court's decision and send this case back. Actually, should reverse the lower court's decision and overturn the case in this regard. If there are no other questions.
Thank you, counsel. The case is now submitted. We thank counsel for your presentation today. That concludes our arguments for this week and concludes our regularly scheduled cases for the calendar year. Wish all the best for the holiday season, and the court will reconvene again in January. At this point, the clerk will adjourn the court.
Court stands adjourned until